Hi, this is Dana Stevens, Slate's movie critic, here with a Slate spoiler special podcast on Greenberg, the new Noah Baumbach film. I was going to say comedy, but do we know if it's a comedy, John?
I don't think I laughed once, but I don't think it is a comedy.
All right, we'll just call it the new Noah Baumbach film, drama, something. Yeah. So here with me in the studio is John Swansburg. Hi, John.
Hi.
Who's Slate's culture editor and who also went with me to see Greenberg last night. And who differed with me, not super strongly, but we did differ on the movie, right? I think that I tolerated it more
you liked
than you
it.
Did.
You liked it more than I did, definitely.
I believe your words walking out of it were, I hated every minute of that.
Did I say that? I think you're right that I said that. I don't know. Now, the next day, I feel a little bit less hatred towards it. There were moments in the movie that, looking back on it, I think were okay. What I really didn't like, maybe a better way of putting it, was I really disliked, maybe hated, spending 2 hours in the company of the character of Greenberg, which I think is actually part of the point of the movie. So that's different than saying I hated the movie.
Well, let's walk through what the story is so people can see why he was either... I agree that he's meant to be a guy that's very hard to be around. I guess the question is, you know, whether you as a viewer experienced that as reason to flee the theater.
Right. I think that's the central question of around this movie.
So as the movie begins, we don't see Greenberg. The first person we see is Florence, the female lead, played by Greta Gerwig, who we see driving along the Sunset Strip, I think, in her car.
Which is an interesting choice, I thought. We can maybe come back to that. But we get a lot of that character before we ever see Greenberg.
Yeah, it's almost as if, she sort of provides this little first chapter of the movie, and you think it's going to be a movie about her. And it starts out quite interesting, showing her day, her frantic day, at her job, which is being a personal assistant to this well-off family in the Hollywood Hills. We don't know exactly what they do or where their money comes from, but they live in a beautiful 1920s mansion up in the Hollywood Hills.
Right.
Chris Messina plays the father, the paterfamilias of this family, and we don't learn very much about the family. We just learn that she is this young, in her mid-20s, personal assistant who's running around getting them ready for this big trip, buying things that they need, packing their bags, getting instructions about feeding their dog, and they're all about to take off for Vietnam for this big trip, and she's going to have this big house. She's not staying in the house, but she's going to be responsible for running this big house.
Right.
And it's first 15 minutes of the movie or so.
Right.
And then you want to take it away with the Greenberg, right?
Sure. So at the same time... While Philip Greenberg and his family are away for 6 weeks in Vietnam, Philip's brother, Roger, is going to come and live in their house, kind of as a house sitter. He's building a dog house for their dog, a German Shepherd named Mahler. But he's also, we sort of get in dribs and drabs, he's sort of a 40-year-old guy who's had a recent setback. He was, I think, institutionalized briefly for some kind of mental breakdown. It's not exactly clear what the nature of it was, but he's sort of this guy who's hit a rough patch. And so Philip Greenberg has invited Roger to come sort of live in their house and, I guess, sort of, you know, regroup, get his life together. When Philip leaves, Roger moves in to the house. And of course, he eventually runs into the Florence character. Florence comes by to pick up a check, I think it is, and they have their first meeting. And then rather quickly, those two become involved. I mean, is involved even the right word here? There's a very in a very abrupt fashion, they have a sexual interlude.
Which... Let's talk about the scene where they first get involved, because you and I also read that really, really differently. I think I did actually laugh aloud during that scene. It's a classic Noah Baumbach scene in that he specializes in the comedy of cringe, right? And incredible awkwardness between people and, you know, messages that don't get through.
Right.
So as it starts out, she's sort of performing assistant duties for Roger Greenberg as well, right? His brother says, if you need anything, if you need errands or shopping done, she can do it for you. And he asks her to pick up whiskey and ice cream sandwiches.
Exactly.
Because
that was a funny detail.
We should mention a little bit about the kind of guy he is before we talk about them getting together, right? I mean, if you haven't been able to tell from the trailer and from the mere fact he's played by Ben Stiller, Greenberg is what? He's in his mid-40s, maybe. He's this incredibly sour, sort of funny in a sharp-tongued way, but sort of absolutely unmarry guy.
He's a crank also. I mean, he's at once sort of diffident and depressed and also arrogant and loudmouthed. Those things sound like they should maybe not be possible in the same person, but they kind of are.
He's incredibly misanthropic.
He's constantly writing letters to like sort of major corporate entities complaining about perceived slights or minor irritations. Like I think in the beginning he writes a letter to American Airlines complaining that the buttons on his seat on his flight over from New York didn't work properly and were not allowing him to recline his chair in the way he wanted to. And, you know, so he's like that kind of, he's that kind of guy. He's no fun to spend any time around.
Right. So then the question becomes, since we know that he's that kind of guy from square one, what would this woman ever see in him? And should we or should we not root for them getting together?
Right.
So the first night that they do get together, do you want to describe what happens and we can talk about our different interpretations of it?
Okay. So let me see if I can remember. He's sort of at home doing nothing, decides to give her a call sort of on a lark and ask her if she wants to go get a beer or get a drink. And one of the funny details about him, and I think this is kind of this was a nice detail, is that Greenberg, one of the reasons he's so alienated in and at sea in L.A. is that he can't drive, so he's forever relying on people to drive him around. So he asks Florence to come pick him up, and they decide they'll go to a bar. She forgets her purse, so she says, "Oh, we need to stop at my apartment first, so I can get my purse, and then we can go out to the bar." Then they get to her apartment, and they decide to just stay there and have a drink instead. Sort of, I think Greenberg is kind of prefers to do it that way. So she doesn't really have anything to drink in the house. So they open the fridge, and there's a single Corona, and they decide to split the Corona.
And there's a really awkward and I thought funny moment where they just stand there looking at each other and passing it back and forth, taking sips, right? And before the beer is even done, he grabs her and starts kissing her. And
they've had two sips of beer each.
And there's virtually no conversation.
Right.
And the next thing you know, he throws her down on the bed and starts performing oral sex on her in this incredibly awkward and embarrassing scene that she obviously is not into it at all and soon after stops him and
right.
stands back up again.
Right.
So to you, this scene, you found this scene really offensive.
Well, I mean, I don't know if it's offensive. I found it bizarre. Like you said, I think there's this open question as to whether we whether we understand at all why the Florence character is interested in the Greenberg character. And I understand that sometimes attractive, more or less winning women fall for arrogant, depressive, bossy men. I understand that that happens. And I understand that that could have happened here. But literally, they've had one brief conversation about ice cream sandwiches and whiskey and a to-do list. They've been in the car for seemingly 5 minutes. They have two or three sentences of an exchange in the apartment, two sips of beer, cunnilingus. I just didn't understand. Like, you know, she's been set up in the beginning as being somewhat, you know, sexually willing to kind of, you know, go with the flow. She hooks up with a guy, and at the tail end of the opening scene, we see her meet a guy at a bar and go home with him and sleep with him. So her sort of sexual liberty has been established. Even so, it seemed almost to me like there was a scene missing where there was some winning exchange between her, you know, her and him, where he said something witty or made some, you know, world weary but kind of fun, funny observation, or, you know, and kind of caught her eye, and so she thought to herself, "Oh, I will lie down on my mattress and let this guy awkwardly perform oral sex on me." I understand that. I think the point of the scene, as you said, was Bomback wanted to give us this really awkward sexual moment, and actually turns out to be not the most awkward sexual moment, arguably, in the movie. There's another one later that gives it a run for its money, but it struck me as a little cheap. Like, it was just, there was no setup for them, for him taking her shirt off and going down on her. So I don't know.
I completely agree that that scene did not fit into the expected rhythm of the romantic comedy, and that there wasn't enough banter beforehand to justify their getting it on.
Right.
But I guess to me that was sort of the awkward, I'm not going to say beauty of that scene, because I don't think it was
please don't.
I don't think it was perfectly done, even as a, you know, awkward comedy of manners kind of thing. But I think the whole point was somewhat supposed to be, we've established before, not only her sexual liberty, but her sexual passivity, right?
Right.
The guy that she goes home with earlier, she sort of hesitates at the door and says, I just got out of a long relationship, and the guy says, "This isn't a relationship." In
right.
other words, you know, whatever. I just want to use you and throw you away. And she says, "Oh, okay," and goes with him. And throughout, there's this ongoing plot point that Greta Gerwig's character is kind of a doormat,
right?
And that Greenberg mistreats her again and again. I don't think that this is something that the viewer just has to discover and get outraged about in the movie. It's something that's right there in the script.
Right.
So then the question becomes: is this about two flawed people that we're rooting for to make something work, or is this about, you know, a doormat and a jerk, and we don't care if they get together? And I guess you would go with the latter on that.
I would go with the latter. And I'm okay with her character being a doormat. I mean, I think that the dynamic could have been interesting. I felt like she was too much of a doormat and he was too much of a jerk. And as such, I was never rooting for them to get together. And he really is a jerk to her. I mean, it's not just, you know, sort of forcing himself on her to some degree sexually in that scene. I mean, he's really, really cruel to her. Even sort of towards the end of the movie, at one point, he tries to apologize to her. And it's like one of the worst apologies that I could, like, in cinematic history. Like, you know, he sort of recognizes that he's been really cruel to her verbally in a previous scene, and he sort of apologizes for it, but also basically says, I'm apologizing for my half of what went wrong in that scene. And it was all him that was wrong. You know, he was just screaming at her. I think what he was screaming at her about in that movie was the fact that she likes spending time with him. Right? I mean, do you remember that scene? Like, she invites him back to her apartment again, she suggests that they hang out again, and he basically balls her out for liking spending time with him. She's like, you are not supposed to do this. You shouldn't like spending time with me.
But to me, again, and I think that there are a few moments in this movie where you do see redeeming characteristics in Greenberg, and that is sort of one of them. I think that's his own self-loathing, sort of trying to save her from a situation that he knows is going to be no good for her.
I suppose.
Let's talk about some of the other characters and some of the stuff that does work. I mean, I would argue that I think that you're right that in most of the scenes in which we see the main couple together, we don't want them to be together.
Right.
But I think that those redeeming characteristics that Greenberg has peek out more in scenes with other characters. For example, his longtime best friend, who's played by the Welsh actor, I hope I'm saying his name right, Rhys Ifans. And the two of them are supposed to have been friends from 20 years back.
Right.
Right. But not to have seen each other in some time and to have grown apart. And many, many years before, I guess back in the 80s, there was supposedly this chance that they were going to have a band deal, that they played in a band and they were going to be able to sign a record deal.
Right.
And that Greenberg, with his typical sort of purism, aesthetic purism, decided that the terms of the record deal were too corporate and it was going to compromise their integrity in some way, and he sabotaged the whole thing.
Right.
And all his band members, his former two band members, are still furious at him 20 years later for having done this.
Right.
And to me, some of these scenes with Rhys Ifans, which were not all about the band question, but were just about their deteriorating relationship in general, were the moments in which you saw the funnier side of Greenberg or the more winning side of him. I thought that their friendship was quite well done.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. So there were three band members who weren't Greenberg. Two of them basically are completely unhappy to see Greenberg show back up in Los Angeles and basically are dismiss him. There was something sweet about the fact that Ivan, the Rhys Ifans character, sort of takes him back and sticks with him despite the fact. You can tell that Ivan recognizes all of Greenberg's shortcomings, and yet he sort of feels this... he sort of feels like he needs to stick with him. He's sort of like that. I mean, I think we all have friends like that, who are people with whom we had a close bond at some point in our life, and then that person does something or changes in a way that, you know, leads a lot of people to kind of give up on them.
Or doesn't change in Greenberg's case, right? He's radically dysfunctional because he's still the same person.
Or becomes more concentrated. Don't you feel like Greenberg in college was probably just as – or was similarly insufferable but maybe not quite – like off the deep end the way he is now or something?
Yeah, and
like,
I actually think that Stiller plays that quite well and Baumbach writes that quite well, that type that, as you say, kind of solidifies and condenses into some kind of parody of themselves.
Like, he was probably like a really funny, snarky guy to hang out with in college. He would make fun of like the dorky kids or the cool kid. You know, you could see him being somewhat charming because he can be funny and quite biting. But now it's just that kind of nasty, caustic nature that's left. There's no kind of joy in being around him. Anyway, it's sort of sweet that Ivan feels some connection and some need to kind of look after him and stick with him, despite the fact that Greenberg is not only no fun to be around, but is actually actively mean to Ivan throughout the movie. At one point, Ivan takes Greenberg out to dinner for his birthday and has the seemingly thoughtful, nice idea of ordering him, you know, a slice of cake with a candle in it, and the bunch of waiters come over and sing happy birthday to Greenberg, and Greenberg just totally flips out. He apparently hates it when people have happy birthday sung to them in public, and he just like screams a string of profanity at Ivan and stomps off. And you know, Ivan doesn't even miss a beat. Like, there's not even a moment where Greenberg calls him up and says, "Hey, sorry, I said sit on my dick to you when you brought out the cake." He just sort of calls him up the next day, and they said, "Hey, you want to hang out?" There is something sweet about that. At the same time, Greenberg is so cruel to Ivan on so many occasions in this movie that about three quarters of the way through, maybe a little bit earlier, I just wanted Ivan to dump him. I just didn't want him to put up with it anymore. He was another doormat, and I just didn't. I personally had a hard time understanding why, like, how you could put up with that guy.
Well, that does, as long as we're spoiling, that does eventually happen. And
it does happen.
One of the more emotionally satisfying scenes of the movie is that very, very late in the movie, after a really hostile exchange, Ivan basically tells him, I can't do this anymore. I can't be friends with you anymore, and storms out. And that's sort of the turning point for Greenberg, actually. In fact, let's go on and spoil what happens with him and Florence, the Greta Gerwig mm-hmm. character, as a result, I think, of this loss of his one friendship.
I can't remember. Does he make the phone call to her after?
That same night.
It's the same night, but is it after the moment with Ivan?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Because he mentions in the phone call. Wait, they don't know what we're talking about.
Sorry. Okay. So towards the end of the movie, Philip Greenberg's wife has a daughter from a previous marriage who's like a 20-something co-ed. She shows up with a friend and they throw this like bender at the Greenberg household.
And I thought this scene was another good set piece, actually. So you have the 40-year-old bitter Greenberg completely surrounded by these frothy, beautiful 20-somethings having this wild party. And he proceeds to spend the entire party essentially trying to ruin it for them, right?
Right.
Playing his Duran Duran music instead
right.
of letting them play their music.
He does a lot of
taking
their drugs.
All their drugs and then going on hostile rants to them.
Yeah, they find him, I think, bemusing at first when he's sort of doing his, like, I'm old, you're young shtick. And then he just gets annoying, like, the sort of more drugged out he gets. And he's, like, jumping over people and fighting with people over the DJing rights. Anyway, so he gets high on coke. He does some over the counter pharmaceutical, psychotropic drugs. He smokes some weed. He has this kind of heated moment with Ivan. Ivan basically walks away. We sort of assume for good, although who knows. And then he kind of retires to a bedroom and he calls Florence. And Florence, I guess we need to backpedal a little bit more too. Florence doesn't pick up because she's recovering from having had an abortion the day before.
It wasn't not of Greenberg's child.
Not of Greenberg's child, of her ex-boyfriend's child. And Greenberg has sort of tried to be there for her during that procedure. And to some extent, he is. To some extent, he isn't.
He offers to take her to get the abortion, but he can't drive. So
right.
he has to get his friend to drive the two of them. There's all kinds of abject moments like that.
That's true. And he's trying to think of what to have waiting for her when she wakes up from the anesthesia after the procedure. And Ivan sort of sensibly suggests flowers, although I suppose that might be a little bit weird, too. But Greenberg thinks, no, she's going to be hungry. So he brings her what appears to be an In-N-Out burger. That actually was a funny scene when Greta Gerwig kind of groggily wakes up from anesthesia and there's just like this close-up shot of a cheeseburger in a wax paper wrapper and she obviously doesn't really want that right away. Anyway, so he calls Florence who's at the hospital, doesn't pick up, and he leaves his kind of meandering voicemail that was pretty well written too. That does a bunch of different things. Among them, reassesses Greenberg's own opinion of Wall Street. It has this great riff on the scene in Wall Street where Charlie Sheen, I guess, walks out on his stoop or deck and says, "Who am I?" And he sort of Greenberg has his own kind of "Who am I?" moment, and essentially confesses that he likes. He likes Florence. He doesn't say, I love you. He says, I like you. And then he treats the voicemail as if it were a letter, since he's such an inveterate letter writer. And he says, I like you. And then he signs off, love, Greenberg. And it's sort of sweet. Right.
Well, and then that gets used in a way that I thought, I mean, although I can't say that I'm absolutely rooting for the two of them to get together at the end because it just seems like it's going to be so disastrous for her. I did think that cinematically there was a sweet touch of the way that was used at the end, because a couple scenes later, he goes over to her place, right? He brings her home from the hospital. She's still kind of recovering.
Right.
And he says, did you get my voicemail? She says, no, I haven't heard them yet. And then there's a kind of nice scene where she listens to her voicemail with him sitting right there. And as the incriminating voicemail, admitting that he likes her, begins, we see his face looking at her, and that's the end of the movie. I thought it was a nice beat for the movie to end on.
I like the ending beat, and it's sort of even cleverer than that, but not too clever, I think, where she is lying down and she's still sort of sleepy, and there are two messages that precede Greenberg's message, one from one of her friends and one from her mother. And so she's lying there, and we can't really hear what's going on the phone, and she says, oh, this one's not you, this is my friend Gina. Oh, no, this one is my mom. And then there's a pause, and then she says, this is you. Which, obviously means, the obvious meaning of that is, oh, this one is your call. But I think the implication is that she's saying, this is you. That voicemail is you. That sort of unguarded moment of you saying, I actually, recognizing your faults and professing, that he's willing to actually admit that he likes Florence, that is the real Greenberg, not the guy we saw, we've seen throughout the movie who's so awful. Which is the double meaning there of "this is you," I thought was also kind of
nice.
I don't know if I believe it.
The last line of the movie, then.
Right.
Right.
And then I think that actually it works really well as a bookend, because we were talking earlier about the kind of opening set piece, which just doesn't have any Greenberg. It's all Florence driving around. And, we see her it's sort of just music and images of her driving around. And but the first line of dialogue in the movie, if you remember, is Greta Gerwig's character trying to change lanes and looking in the rearview mirror, and she says, "Are you going to let me in? Let me in." Which, again, is like has an obvious meaning of she's trying to get into that lane, but the movie really is about her, you know, getting Greenberg to let her into his life.
Look at you. For someone who hated it, you've got some nice readings of the first and last line.
I thought those moments were, you know, were nice. I don't, but again, I guess my problem with it is that I at the end of the day, I didn't want her to be let into Greenberg's life because, like you said, I don't think that's going to end well for her. And she seemed, while doormat-ish, not as nearly as screwed up as Greenberg. And I could only see her getting more screwed up by spending her life with, or any more time with Roger Greenberg. So, while I thought those moments had some nice resonance, I still didn't want that relationship to happen.
Let's take a quick break for a word from our sponsor, which is Audible.com. As regular listeners know, if you sign up for a one-book-a-month subscription to Audible through our URL, which is www.audiblepodcast.com/spoiler, you'll get a credit good for one free book. And that book is yours to keep, even if you cancel your subscription during the 2-week trial period. Again, that address is www.audiblepodcast.com/spoiler. And our recommendations for this week are loosely inspired by the movie. Baumbach has mentioned that he's influenced by a few mid-century writers for the character of Greenberg, people who write about men at a moment of crisis in their lives. And some of the ones that he cited were Saul Bellow, Philip Roth, John Updike. So we took a look around Audible and just randomly chose one of those, the one who has the most representation on Audible, I believe, which is Philip Roth. And you can find a lot of Philip Roth. I believe 24 books of Philip Roth are available on Audible, plus a lot of interviews with him and a Fresh Air interview with him. So the ones that we'll just pluck at random out of the large set of offerings are American Pastoral, which is read by Ron Silver, interestingly, and The Human Stain, narrated by Dennis Boutsakaris. Both of those are available unabridged on Audible, so check it out. So I don't think we should finish talking about Greenberg without talking about the casting, because the casting of Ben Stiller in this movie is clearly what's going to draw a lot of people to the movie who might not otherwise see an independent Noah Baumbach movie of this sort.
Right.
But it also, I think, is something that sort of drives a wedge into the heart of the movie, not because Stiller's bad in it. I actually think that he's quite good in the role, and it seems to be exploring, you know, parts of himself as an actor that he hasn't gotten to in a while, because he's not playing for the laughs, right? I mean, he gets some laughs, but he's not playing for the laughs, big broad laughs. But he's Ben Stiller, and you just can't get away from that. And he has to hold the camera so much in this movie. He's in virtually every scene, a lot of them completely by himself and silent.
Right.
And you really have to read a lot into just the, you know, the motions and the expressions on his face. And at every moment you see him, you're seeing Zoolander and you're seeing Night at the Museum. You know, you can't not be seeing these things.
Yeah.
Did that bother you as well?
It did. It definitely did. You were saying last night when we left the movie that, you know, it was sort of an act of will constantly in this movie to be forgetting that he's Ben Stiller. And I definitely was struggling with that, too. And I think part of the problem is he really does. It's not just, oh, it's Ben Stiller in a Noah Baumbach movie. It's Ben Stiller in a Noah Baumbach movie that if you were to take him out, it would almost, the cast would look like the cast of a mumblecore movie. I mean, Greta Gerwig is very much a mumblecore transplant, but Mark Duplass, who plays one of the ex-bandmates, is also a guy who came out of the mumblecore movement. And
as an actor and a director, both.
Right. And so the Ben Stiller is the only real actor on screen who has anything like that Hollywood cachet, with the exception, I guess, of Jennifer Jason Leigh, who co-wrote the movie. Is that right?
That's right. She's Noah Baumbach's wife, and she co-wrote the screenplay.
Right. So I guess one scene that I thought was relatively strong, and I think it's perhaps no accident, is so Jennifer Jason Leigh is in the movie and plays Beth, who was, I guess, the woman who Greenberg dated during the height of his band days and college days. And he has a somewhat awkward coffee date with her sort of in the middle of the movie. And Greenberg, she has children but is divorced. And I think Greenberg has this, what's clear to the audience, absurd hope that they'll somehow rekindle their relationship. And that scene I thought was really great, in part because I think Jennifer Jason Leigh's character in that scene is sort of a proxy for us, because she isn't really taking any of Greenberg's shit. And she doesn't really remember. Greenberg's clearly like he's sort of obsessed with their relationship and remembers these little details from nights that they hung out, and she's like, I don't remember that. I don't remember that happening. And she completely takes the wind out of his sails in a way for me, at least, was somewhat cathartic, because I wanted someone to take the wind out of this guy's sails because he's so annoying. And she basically does that. And I thought in that scene, the movie worked pretty well. And I wondered if it was in part because Jennifer Jason Leigh is, you know, someone who you kind of expect to see in a scene with Ben Stiller.
Yeah, who maybe has the Hollywood star weight to play against him more successfully. It's almost unfair to Greta Gerwig that she gets to play someone who's bulldozed by her boyfriend, and her boyfriend is played by a Hollywood actor who essentially does sort of bulldoze her in terms of recognizability quotient.
And that's not to take anything away from any of the other actors. I actually think all of the actors in the movie were pretty good. I mean, I thought Greta Gerwig's performance was well done, and I thought the Reese Ifans performance was also pretty great. It's just there is just this disparity between the star power. And it's a little distracting.
I think that this might have been, I hate to say it because I do think Stiller does a good job, but I think just in terms of his sheer star power that this would have been a stronger movie with somebody else in that role.
Yeah,
It sounds, though, like during the course of our conversation or in the, 24 hours since you've seen it, you're won over a little bit more to liking this movie than you were at the time. Happy not to be in it anymore?
Exactly. I don't know. I didn't like the movie. There were parts of it that I think worked pretty well.
You don't like Noah Baumbach in general.
But yeah, I don't really like Noah Baumbach in general. I think I understand why he makes movies about the kind of people that he makes movies about, and I sort of think that that's interesting, but I just don't enjoy spending time with those characters. I just don't. It's not really that kind of the cringes that he seems to enjoy inducing in his audience, and the kinds of assholes he likes to portray in his movies. That's not what I want when I go to the movie. I don't want to spend time with people like that. That's not to take away. I think there are people who do enjoy that more than I do, and I think that he's very good at it. But I think it's just purely a matter of taste. I don't think that the movie was poorly executed. I think it was, in a lot of ways, it was really well executed. I just didn't enjoy it.
Its sour worldview was just something that you couldn't bring yourself to.
Exactly. Dana was you were kind enough to before the screening last night go to a very good French patisserie and pick up some eclairs, and you got one for me, and we weren't able to eat them before the screening because we were running a little bit late, but on the way out you gave me a chocolate eclair that was to die for, and I sort of felt like that was really necessary after that movie, like ending the night without that eclair to sort of like cleanse my palate.
It's a Noah Baumbach antidote.
Yeah, so like maybe this is just the eclair effect. I'm sort of I'm remembering the eclair more than the movie. But that
so
was a
you
damn good eclair.
You recommend this movie if slathered with a thick layer of crème anglaise?
Exactly. You need something sweet afterwards to restore your faith in humanity.
All right. Well, John, thanks so much for seeing this bitter movie with me and having a sweet eclair.
My pleasure. Thanks again for the eclair.
And thanks for joining me for this Slate spoiler special. For Slate.com, I'm Dana Stevens.